welcome to another terrific episode of Musings on Golf. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my great friend and co-host, Bob Bupka. And Bob, our listeners are going to be blown away by the incredible project called Apogee, which our guest today, former USGA CEO Mike Davis, is helping to oversee. We'll also talk Tiger and Bob Jones and look ahead to a very strong field at the Arnold Palmer Invitational. How you doing, Bob?
Yeah, lots of great news in golf. Of course, I'm excited now about the 2026 United States Open. That's my target goal. I want to be around for that one. That will mark, listen to this, Mr. Elbin, that'll mark the 40th anniversary of me doing my first U.S. Open at Shinnecock in 2026. More good news for Shinnecock, too. In 36, they're not only going to have the men's Open there, but they're going to follow in the footsteps of Pinehurst, and they're going to have the women's Open, men's Open, back-to-back, Shinnecock, 2036. That I must admit, that might be a little bit ambitious for me for 36, but I think I got enough gas in the tank to make it to 2026.
There's every reason to believe that you're going to be around and calling golf in 36. I have no doubt. Hey, Bob, tell me, it's never played Shinnecock. Those who are listeners who haven't, you're a very, very proud Long Islander. What is it about Shinnecock Hills that's so special? And it's Bob, it's the only club that's hosted the U.S. Open in three different centuries.
Well, there's no finer golf course in America than Shinnecock. Nobody knew about Shinnecock. Shinnecock was a secret. And then there was a meeting back in 1981 to see if Shinnecock would host a U.S. Open. And a gentleman from the USGA didn't get the credit that he deserves, but he certainly deserves it, by the name of Frank Hannigan. He went out to speak to the members of Shinnecock. He talked to the board of directors. They said, leave us alone. We're going to go in executive session. They go back in executive session. They come out. They say, Mr. Hannigan, Shinnecock's going to pass on the U.S. Open. We just don't have the membership. It'll be too big an inconvenience. We regretfully are going to pass. Frank Hannigan, on his own, says, can I make another suggestion? And Shinnecock said, what is that? Mr. Hannigan says, how about if we rent Shinnecock for the 86 Open? They said, what do you mean? We'll pay you rent. We'll run the whole affair. You don't have to worry about volunteers. You don't have to worry about anything. And that was such a success that the USGA put that method in play for future U.S. Opens. And I can only begin to think how much more money the USGA has made by renting U.S. Open golf courses now rather than having the golf course itself be the host. So the name Frank Hannigan did a world of wonders financially for the U.S. Open.
And for the USGA, as you said. And Mr. Hannigan, a very influential individual within the United States Golf Association. That's a great story. And just by coincidence, we have Mike Davis on this week as our special guest. Mike spent a decade, Bob, as the CEO of the USGA, very involved with the setup of U.S. Opens. And I thought, you know, I did the interview on my own. You were a little under the weather that day. But in talking to Mike, I was struck by just how straightforward he was about the good and the bad of those years with those course setups. And it kind of goes back, Bob, to what defines the United States Open Golf Championship, the toughest test in golf, right?
Yeah, it really is. And one other thing about Shinnecock, believe it or not, let's say a tragedy strikes somewhere in June, and the following week's going to be the U.S. Open. Well, you can go out, tee it up at Shinnecock. You're going to be as if all the normal preparations were put in play. That golf course is U.S. Open ready every time the members tee it up. I mean, that is an incredible statement. And what makes it really ironic, I've had people over the years, Kelly, and they want to come to Long Island, they want to play golf. My question always is, well, do you want an experience or do you want a test? If they want to experience an experience, we got to go to National. National Golf Course stands alone as far as an experience goes. But if you want a test, there's no doubt, and not only in my mind, but you can get a majority of the players on the PGA Tour right now will tell you Shinnecock's the best U.S. Open test in America.
Certainly one individual who would aspire to not only play in the 26 U.S. Open, but win it is Tiger Woods. And again, one more USGA note of significance. The United States Golf Association has named Tiger as its 2024 recipient of the Bob Jones Award, its highest honor. He and Jones, by the way, are the only players to win 9 USGA titles. But 9. Tiger's going to be honored during the week of the U.S. Open in June at Pinehurst. Very, very deserving honor for an extraordinary athlete and player who really, you talk about redefining the game. That's what Tiger Woods has done.
Yeah, and let me jump in here real quick. I was so saddened to miss Mike Davis. Mike Davis, in all of my dealings with him, he was a straight shooter. He told me like it was. He told me what I could do, what I couldn't do. And he was wonderful for the USGA. He had it in his soul. He had it in his heart. He had it in his blood. Mike Davis bleeds USGA blood. And on top of that, you know, he's a terrific guy. I mean, with all his talent and all his love of golf, he's a wonderful human being off the golf course. And Mike, sorry I missed you, but I know you were absolutely terrific.
Yeah, I've known Mike for a number of years, and everything you say, I repeat that. And that's a good point in regards to his soul, Bob. He is this guy was designing golf courses with scribbles when he was a kid. He wanted to work in golf. He's a lifer. And you know, I mentioned Tiger, and he's playing as we record this the afternoon of Monday, the 4th of March, he's playing in the Seminole Pro Member, which it's the greatest non-major event in golf. I mean, and this, by the way, it's the first time he's playing in it. And Bob, I wonder, what's the last time Tiger Woods played in an event where there were no cameras? I mean, he's playing today with PGA of America CEO Seth Waugh. Tom Brady, who's a member at Seminole, is playing with Tony Finau. Rory's playing with his dad, Jerry, who's a member there. Nelly Korda, Matt Fitzpatrick, Colin Morikawa. The who's who of the tour, but no live players for the second straight year.
Let me ask you this, Kelly. You know, to me, it's absolutely amazing that Seminole Pro Member is the biggest, best pro member held each year in this country. And I know the draw is a strictly blind draw. And old lucky Seth Waugh ends up with Tiger Woods. Boy, that's a lucky guy. I think I want Seth Waugh to go with me to Las Vegas.
I think Mr. Waugh maybe had some influence in getting Tiger out there. I think it's great. Hey, Bob, it's funny to me, isn't it? Tiger Woods has become and is sort of the senior statesman, if you will, in golf right now. He and Phil Mickelson have completely flipped the script. I mean, Phil Mickelson, for years and years, he was the guy mentoring the kids. He was the guy everybody was looking up to. Now Tiger's the guy. Tiger's the guy getting the Bob Jones Award. Phil Mickelson's not the one being invited to play at Seminole. But Phil's, you know, played over in Saudi Arabia. And Joaquin Niemann, I mean, there's no hotter golfer right now in the world. I don't care how you feel about LIV Golf. And you cannot, you know, you look at the leaderboards of these PGA Tour events. Austin Eckroat won the rain-delayed Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches, first PGA Tour victory. Lowry was around. Rory made triple on 16 in the third round and really knocked himself out. But you look at the players playing in LIV, and for Niemann, who received that special invitation from Fred Ridley to play at the Masters, his third win in 3 months, his second win in 3 starts on LIV Golf. He's hot right now, man.
Yeah, he certainly is. And William and Harry, their golf shoes are absolutely spectacular. If you see them, you want to wear them. And if you wear them, you're going to play better golf.
Hey, Bob, a couple of quick things before we get to Mike Davis. Really happy to see that Gary Woodland has been named the recipient of the Golf Writers Association of America's Ben Hogan Award. It goes to an individual who remains active in golf despite a physical handicap or serious illness. And boy, oh boy, Gary in September had surgery to remove a brain lesion. 2019 U.S. Open champion. He's battled back, made the cut at Genesis a few weeks ago. What a great guy. And talk about deserving of that honor.
Yeah, absolutely. And Gary's another one of those guys. As great as he is on the golf course, he's even better as a person and a human being. Congratulations to you, Gary. So well deserved.
Strong field at the Arnold Palmer Invitational this week, Bob. It's one of the signature events on the PGA Tour. 70 players. There is a cut to the low 50. And that's one of only three signature events: Arnold's event, Jack's Memorial, and Tiger's Genesis. The rest of the signature events are 4-day no cuts, but very, very strong field. Mike Davis, again, you're really going to enjoy hearing from him, having to do with his days at the USGA, what he's doing at the incredible Apogee here in Southeast Florida, right after this from William and Harry. Introducing the epitome of golfing elegance and performance from William and Harry. Immerse yourself in style and unparalleled comfort as you step onto the green with William & Harry's unique durable deerskin and calfskin masterpiece. Unrivaled in its water-resistant design, the WH shoe, which is also available in private label, ensures that you stay focused on your swing even in unpredictable weather conditions. Elevate your game to where luxury meets peak performance. Step into excellence. Step into innovation at williamandharry.com.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Unfortunately, our good friend Bob Bupka is a little bit under the weather, and he's not going to be able to join us today, but we do have a heck of a golf figure joining us. Our special guest today certainly knows his way around great golf course designs. He was the setup man for the United States Open Golf Championship before his decade as executive director and then CEO of the United States Golf Association. Since his retirement from the USGA, his passion for great golf course architecture has continued with his current work at the extraordinary Apogee, a 54-hole complex in Southeast Florida that very well may be unrivaled when it is completed. He's with us today to talk about Apogee and a whole lot more. My friend Mike Davis, welcome to Musings on Golf.
Kelly, it's wonderful to be with you. And I was very sorry to hear Bob wasn't going to be with us. I had so many good memories. Bob was always that smiling face in the media center at the U.S. Open. He was always somebody that just I enjoyed my time with. So pass along my very best to him, and hopefully he'll get well soon.
I shall indeed. Hey, Mike, if you look at the definition of the word apogee, one that I saw is the highest point in the development of something, the pinnacle, if you will. I'm interested to know what's unique about Apogee. Talk about that, please, your role that you and your business partner, Tali Fazio, have taken with the project. It is an incredible undertaking, isn't it?
Kelly, it is. I mean, it's unique in the sense of the sheer scope of Apogee. It's a private, high-end club. We opened to our members December of last year. We got the first course done, which was a Gil Hanse design. But, you know, it starts with its location. It's 1,200 acres that's just west of downtown Hope Sound, so just a little north of Jupiter, Florida. It's just into Martin County, so just a little north of Palm Beach County, which is a real golf mecca. I mean, I think most people would consider Palm Beach County and that general area that it's in is kind of the capital of golf in Florida, and Florida is the biggest state in terms of most golfers, most golf courses. Sure. And so when you think about the scale of this, I mean, what is, you asked about what's unique. The fact that it's 54 holes of golf, three different designers, it's two short courses, it's two practice ranges, one of which is a 360-degree range that my partner Tommy Fazio and I designed. It's got country club amenities, or it will have it. It's going to have pool, spa, fitness, you know, racket sports such as tennis, pickleball, padel. It has fishing. And what it doesn't, and it'll have cottages for member use. They're owned by the club. But what it doesn't have, Kelly, is it's not a real estate development. And that's why it's so unusual. And I'm hard-pressed to think, you know, as I think about in the United States, how many private clubs that aren't real estate developments have three golf courses and this many amenities? And the only one that really comes to mind is Saucon Valley Country Club in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is a wonderful golf course and club. Got three courses and a short six-hole course and all the country club amenities. But even that, and I'm very familiar because I was a member there for years, but even that, three quarters of a century in to get to that point, and we're creating it all at once. So to do this, listen, it takes, you know, it's a bold vision. We've got two wonderful owners in Michael Pascucci. And, you know, for those that don't know, Michael Pascucci was the founder of Sabonic Golf Club, which sits right beside Nashville Golf Links in Shinnecock Hills in Southampton, New York. Just a wonderful human being. And you know, when Tommy Fazio and I came up with this concept, this vision of two or three golf courses in this area, because we knew there was demand for golf in this area, even before COVID, we went to him, and he literally 10, 15 minutes into the conversation says, "I'm in." And then, you know, as we started to work through the details and how many cottages, two clubhouses, we decided to, you know, that having another partner owner involved, Stephen Ross, who Stephen wanted to buy a golf course somewhere in North Palm Beach County. And that's really how it came to mind. And he's a member of Sabonic, so Michael Pascucci knew him. And so the two of them together, you know, this is a legacy project for them. They are two very philanthropic people. I mean, Stephen Ross, largest real estate developer, private developer in the United States, owns the Miami Dolphins, brought Formula One racing to Miami, and really has transformed West Palm Beach, and obviously done stuff in New York, Los Angeles, all over. But, you know, these two guys, I think they're the reason Apogee is happening, because it really takes incredible financial underpinning to do something like this. And it takes patient money, because this is one of these things. Why it's not done is it's a big financial commitment, but we're off to a great start. Gil Hance designed the first golf course. Tommy Fazio and I are designing the second, and we're actually building it as we speak. And then a guy named Kyle Phillips, who's a fantastic designer, is doing the third. And, you know, our role, Tom Fazio and my role, is really to just oversee, you know, beyond the vision and, you know, helping get the permitted and helping with the master plan. We are doing all the golf course construction in-house. So literally, you know, a couple years ago, we went to the two owners and said, you know, we mathed this, you know, we ran the math, the numbers on it, and it made sense to buy brand new bulldozers, excavators, giant, I mean, we own 16 giant dump trucks. We're transplanting all the trees ourselves. I mean, it is a giant operation. It's been fun, but when it's all said and done, this is going to be really, in some ways, a club without peer in the United States. It's really just going to be a great project, and we're off to a good start. The first golf course has been open for about 3 months, and it's gotten very good reviews, and Gil Hance and his partner Jim Wagner did a marvelous job.
It really has gotten terrific reviews, Mike. And the having those deep pockets is obviously, as you said, extremely important. Talk a little bit, though, about the relationship you have with Tommy Fazio. Everyone knows Tom Fazio, his uncle. Why Tommy? What was that partnership like from a business standpoint?
Well, Tommy, I've known for probably 25 years. He I guess I got to know him when a place called Lamington Farms Golf Club was first being built, and now it's become Trump National Bedminster.
Oh,
his uncle. So this obviously the Fazio family is legendary in golf course design. Tommy's, my partner's Tommy, his great uncle was George Fazio, who was, by the way, runner up to Ben Hogan, the 1950 U.S. Open at Marion, is in a playoff and lost. And then his two nephews were Jim Fazio, which is Tommy's father, and then Tom Fazio, which is Tommy's uncle. So this family, they've been designing great golf courses for three generations. Tommy lives in Jupiter. My wife and I had a house, still have a house, and moved here permanently. And we just clicked. I mean, to be honest, he's got a skill set that I will never have. I mean, he is so learned when it comes to building golf courses. His mind thinks in 3D. And, you know, I really wanted something where we were, you know, to do design work where we would be involved in building the golf course too. It wasn't just drawing up a plan, you know, a grading plan, a routing plan, and a landscaping plan and handing it to a contractor. And that's one of the things that really appealed to me is you're out in the dirt, you're working with the shapers, and you're really creating something. And, you know, there are quite a few other design teams that do that. There's other design teams that, you know, really are just straight designers and hand the plans over to a contractor, but that's what appealed really to with me with Tommy, and I have just had a great time so far with this project with him. I've learned a lot from him, and listen, I've been around a long time. I've seen a lot of golf courses around the world. I've studied design. I've read about it. When I was at the USJ, worked with quite a few other designers if we were doing work for a US Open or some other championship. But it's different when you're actually doing the plans, building it. It's, as I say, a steep learning curve, and I'm enjoying it immensely.
No, Mike, that you are very proud to be from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. And I read that you did a lot of doodling of golf course design as a kid. Why? What was the passion, the interest from an early age in design? Obviously, you were a good player, but it went far beyond that early on, right?
Yeah, Kelly, I don't know. For some reason, I have just, ever since I was a junior golfer, had this fascination with golf courses and golf course design to the point, literally, and that holds true to this day. I get more of a kick out of seeing golf courses, understanding how the design works, how golfers of varying abilities play, the strategy, the choices you make, the agronomics. I literally get more interest and more joy out of that than how well I shoot in a round of golf. I really, and I've been like that for, you know, literally since I was a young junior golfer. I grew up in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, which is south central Pennsylvania, pretty close to the Maryland border.
Yeah.
And my family was a member of Chambersburg Country Club. In fact, I'm still an honorary member there today. Great little course. It's got good strategy, elevation changes. It's got a beautiful trout stream that runs through it. And so to your point, I, for some reason, always used to doodle holes. And when I look back, you know, most of them was all about options, strategy, you know, double fairways, greens that fed somewhere, streams that ran through the middle of the hole. And, you know, so I've been like this. And then, you know, as I was playing competitive junior golf, I got the chance to play Oakmont out in Pittsburgh and Marion in Philadelphia, you know, Lancaster Country Club in Pennsylvania. And these are some of the great golf courses, not only in the state, but the country and even the world. And that really, you know, piqued my appetite. And then I remember somehow I won the Pennsylvania Junior Championship in the early 1980s. And this gentleman named Jay Weaver, who was the president of the Pennsylvania Golf Association, who also happened to be a member of Marion, asked my father and I to go play Pine Valley. And I think I was 17 at the time. And what I remember is that was the absolute ultimate in golf course design. And it was, to this day, it was one of the best rounds of golf I ever played. And I'm a member there now, but I just recall thinking, how could somebody nearly 100 years ago build something that great? I mean, there's not one even mediocre hole at Pine Valley. And so all those things to this day, when I fast forward to my USGA years, I was there 32 years. And one of the great perks, I mean, I got to meet a lot of great people, go to a lot of events, influence the game. One of the great perks was seeing most of the world's great golf courses, seeing them, studying them, playing them. I love that. And in that, that never would have happened without the USGA. And so that just, to where I am now is just helped me understand where, there's themes of things you see where you say, you might say, oh, I really like that feature on whatever. The drive at the sixth hole at Pine Valley is one of the great drives in all of golf. And it's not just because it's a risk-reward cutoff as much as you want, but it's got a convex fairway that works at an angle. And it's just, when you play there, you realize how amazing that strategy is on that particular hole. So that sticks in your mind, and you say, okay, as I'm designing holes or thinking about how we might do it, there's themes and things that really are neat in golf course design, and they stuck with me. So I can't offer up, Tommy Fazio on necessarily how to build a golf course and drain it, but I can offer up, just thoughts on how players of varying abilities might play it, how it would play from the back tee, and I would play with different grasses. And so it's been a fun partnership so far with Tom.
Mike Davis with us on Musings on Golf. Hey, Mike, I saw a reference to the term golfer friendly as it relates to Apogee. What does that mean? What does it mean for whether it's all three of the courses or one of them? What's the term mean to you, as someone who's run an organization and as a golfer?
It's about making the golf experience fun, and fun for all abilities. And so that was one of the things from the very beginning at Apogee. We knew we wanted three different design teams because we wanted the golf courses each to have their own personality. And we've done that. But one of the things we all set out to do is saying, we want to make a golf course welcoming to the beginner, and we want to make it welcoming to the PGA Tour player. And so all three golf courses are going to have teeing grounds as short as 4,000 yards, but there's back tees, 75 to 7,800 yards and everything in between. We have very few forced carries. There might be forced carries for the back tee player, but for the average player and the beginner, you're going to be able to play all three of these golf courses. You can, in a lot of cases, bounce balls into greens. I know on Gill's course, one of the themes, it's a low profile, wonderfully designed course, kind of cut through some beautiful native vegetation. We've sand capped the whole thing. It's a bouncy golf course, but it's about the ground game. And so it really is. And the other thing I didn't say, which is very important, is there's a lot of width to these courses, and that's purposeful. So there's a lot of angles, and I know the course Tom and I are designing, there's choices on how to play each hole. I mean, virtually on all 18 holes, you've got choices on how you want to play it. And I just happen to think that makes the game more interesting, more cerebral. And, Gil's done that. Gil and Jim Wagner have done that on their course, where it's very much about the ground game. And so each is going to have its own personality, and it's, different vegetations, different topography. I mean, Tom and I are moving a lot of dirt on our golf course. It's a very flat piece of sandy property, but ours is going to be very different than Gill's, which is very, that's what we set out to do. So that's kind of what we mean by golf friendly. It's just, it's welcoming for all levels of players, and hopefully at the end of the day, very fun for everybody that plays it.
And Mike, how did you get your start at the USGA? I'm wondering that. And also, was in fact working for a national golf organization, was that on the wish list for you professionally coming out of Georgia Southern?
It was. I mean, I ultimately, Kelly, wanted to do something in the world of golf. And if that didn't work out, I wanted to do something in, kind of real estate development. But those two areas really piqued my interest. So, like so many people in golf, I knew some people in golf. I sent a resume to the USGA, and I had had the utmost respect for the organization when I was a junior golfer and amateur, and knew some people. And then, to this day, I mean, that respect's only grown. But I sent a resume and then was out of college for about 3 years. And then I was asked to come up to New Jersey. I was living at the time in Georgia. And I interviewed with David Fay, who was my predecessor as executive director, and Mike Butts, and then this legendary guy named PJ Boatwright. And they offered me a job, and I ended up doing the advance work for the U.S. Open, the Senior Open, U.S. Amateur, Walker Cup, and worked some of the smaller championships, and became an expert with the rules of golf, and did some teaching of that. So it was, listen, I've had this love my whole life of golf, and so to actually make your living doing it. It was, at times you'd pinch yourself saying, I would pay to do this. I'm getting paid to do it. So it was just, one of those things, right place at the right time, I suppose.
When you have a high profile position like yours, setting up major championships, running an organization like the USGA, you're always going to come under fire. It's just kind of, I guess, the nature of the position, right? And you took a lot of slings through the years, the association did for course setups for the Open. Were they fair? Did you make any adjustments based on player input, media input, et cetera?
Yeah, Kelly, I'm afraid this actually just comes with the territory. If you go back in time, the U.S. Open in particular was the one that stuck out. It got the most attention and most eyeballs, most media. And if you go back in time, there was always some banter between the players and the USGA, and there was always some chirping. In fact, I can remember PJ Boatwright, who set up the U.S. Open for years, in his Southern drawl, saying, "Mac, if the players are all happy, you've done something wrong." And because the U.S. Open, going back to 1895, was always about testing skills, testing the mental side, testing course, how you handled yourself in around the golf course. And so we set it up in a very, very difficult manner. I mean, it was, most years it was the hardest event all year, and it was on hard golf courses. So there was always going to be some of that. I mean, you think back at the massacre at Wingfoot in 1974, you think about 1950 at Oakland Hills, Hogan winning. And so there's a long history. Even if you go back to Myopia Hunt Club in the 1890s, I mean, look at the scores they were shooting and read about that. So listen, some of the criticism were absolutely spot on. What we tried to do was, to identify the player who could control his or her golf ball that was accurate, that could recover when in trouble, that was, strategically could work their way around the golf course. But listen, there were times then things just didn't go well with setup. I mean, I think about 2018, I was involved then, and with setup. I was executive director, CEO at the time, so I was doing some other things too. But I think about on that Saturday when a couple hole locations became very squirrely, specifically the 13th green and the 15th green. And what people don't realize is that the hole locations actually weren't bad there. What happened was, by mistake, the back nine that day never got watered. The greens never got watered, like the front nine. So three quarters of the field played those hole locations. They were perfectly fine. And then what happened is the grass finally ran out of, water, and it wilted, and there was no friction on it. So, it was things like that happen sometimes. I think back, Well, listen, here's what I would say is we got actually internally probably more criticism when the U.S. Open was too easy than when it was too hot. I remember I probably got more criticism than ever in 2011 when Rory McIlroy shot 16 under at Congressional. He won by 8 shots. He played beautifully. But I had, without naming names, at least a half dozen former U.S. Open champions call me up and in different ways chew me out saying that wasn't a U.S. Open. You got to be ashamed of yourself. And
yeah,
and thousands of people wrote in saying that wasn't a U.S. Open. So it was strange because it was the one event all year long that people seem to care what you shoot. All the other events, it's just whatever the low score is on 72 holes and you give the trophy away. But so I think it just comes with the territory. And listen, what you have to do is admit if you make a mistake, own up to it and learn from it and move on. And I, you know, like to think that's what happened. But listen, there's so many proud memories I've got of the U.S. Open. I mean, some of the innovations, I mean, that we came up with of moving team grounds around and trying to really showcase the architecture, different dry zones, and you know, maybe we goose a hole location one day, and so we move the tee markers up. There was risk reward drivable par fours that really weren't done. If you think about it, yeah. You know, winged foot on that sixth hole that really made a difference in 2006. I mean, in 2007, the second hole and the 17th hole were drivable par fours, And Jim Furyk would have won that U.S. Open had he not been aggressive on those two par fours. And I think about, you know, Marion in 2013 and the short little 13th hole where Phil Mickelson could have won that Open and was just too aggressive on a hole that played less than 100 yards that day. You know, we did the graduated rough. I'll always be proud of that back-to-back U.S. Open at Pinehurst when we played, you know, the men one week and the women the next. And I think what that did, Kelly, was it proved if you set up in a light manner, same clubs being hit into green, same green speed, same hole locations.
Yeah.
And you set it up properly. And I remember we used roughly 72,000 data points from that first week to really pinpoint how we were going to set up the second week. And when you go back and look at that, those opens, virtually the same scoring average for the field over 72 holes. And so there's little things like that. I mean, I think about the U.S. Open in Torrey Pines in 2008 with Tiger winning on a fractured leg. You know, that was just great stuff. But listen, you do get the criticism. And I mean, speaking of Tiger, I think probably the greatest feat beyond him winning 9 championships, of which I actually was a part of all 9 of those, which I look back on with fond memories. But when he won by 15 shots at Pebble Beach in the year 2000, you cannot believe the amount of complaints we got at the USGA because he set a new scoring record at 12 under. And we had people saying, you should never go back to Pebble Beach again. It's too easy. And you say to yourself, wait a minute. The next best score on that championship was +3. And the guy wins. It's one of the most remarkable feats in championship golf ever to win by 15 shots. And people were saying Pebble Beach isn't hard. So, you know, you do take it all with a grain of salt. And, you know, as I say, it comes with the territory.
That's a great response. Mike Davis joining us, and we're coming to the closing holes here on Musings on Golf. Hey, Mike, obviously the U.S. Open goes back to Pinehurst this year, and then next year, the Ryder Cup goes to Bethpage Black at a massive state park. Please talk a little bit about your involvement with really, sort, if you will, sort of discovering Bethpage, the Black course there as a major championship venue, hosting the Opens. It's had a PGA championship. What was your role there, Mike?
Well, credit where credit due. David Fay, who was, again, my predecessor, my boss, wonderful executive director and just terrific to work for. This was really his baby. He grew up in New York. He knew Bethpage. One of his great friends is a fellow by the name of Jay Mottola, who was the longtime, you know, revered executive director of the Met Golf Association in New York. And I think between the two of them, they came up with this idea, because I can remember sitting in my office one day and David Fay comes in, he pulls Mike Butts in, who was one of my colleagues running the U.S. Open. And he told the two of us, he goes, I've got this idea. And he goes on to say, you know, I think we should take a U.S. Open to Bethpage. I want us to go out and explore this. And so anyway, fast forward, you know, a few weeks, and we went out on this supposed covert trip to Bethpage, a few of us, you know, maybe there was four or five of us, and we plunked our money down on the counter, like, you know, tried to act like we, you know, we worked from the USGA, and we played the black course. And I can remember that vividly, where the course was in dreadful, and I do mean dreadful condition. The bunkers were like quicksand. The greens had weeds in it. The tees were unlevel, and there were mostly dirt. But you could see what David Fay saw. It had great bones. And David really orchestrated getting the state of New York, going the whole way up to Governor Pataki involved, and Commissioner of Parks and Rec, a woman named Bernadette Castro. And then David got Reese Jones, the architect, to do pro bono work. And anyway, so essentially the USGA paid for the golf course to be redone, new irrigation, drainage, you know, reworked, reseeded the greens. And listen, Kelly, it was the proverbial win-win. You know, Tiger went on to win that U.S. Open, and really the rest is history. But I think as much as anything, what that did was it proved to the world, because there was always this, you know, if it was a municipal course and not a high-end, you know, resort course like Pinehurst or Pebble Beach or something like that, but this was a municipal golf course owned by the state of New York, and it proved that, you know, if you gave it the resources, it didn't matter who played on it. It mattered how good the golf course was, and that was just a marvelous U.S. Open. We had another great one in 2009, and I mean, I can't wait for next year's Ryder Cup. It's what a venue that's going to be for the PGA of America and for those 24 players playing in that.
Oh, no question. And there'll be a few fans. There'll be a little noise there, Mike.
Yes, there will. no doubt. I mean, the Long Islanders, you know, like to cheer, and so it'll be an interesting one. I'm not sure I'd want to be on that European team, but we'll see how everything sorts itself out.
And Mike Davis, we like to ask each of our guests if they could have three others to complete a dream foursome, whether those individuals are alive or no longer with us. Who would they be, and what round of golf? Where would you play that round of golf?
You know, Kelly, it's such an interesting question. I've had this before and I've thought about it. I think I'd give you two answers, and I know you only want one answer, but
it's okay.
From a sentimental standpoint, I would pick, if he was still alive, my grandfather, my father, who is alive and age 90, and my son, and we play at Chambersburg Country Club, where I grew up. I learned how to play the game, and I still have even done some design work there. If it weren't for the sentimental, and it was kind of that dream foursome, if it weren't a group of three, you know, architects, whatever, like George Thomas, Harry Gold, George Crump, something like that, it would be Bob Jones, Ben Hogan, and Tiger Woods. And I'll tell you why, and I'll caveat that, you know, I've played with Jack Nicklaus, I played with Arnold Palmer and a lot of the greats. And so I kind of take them and set them to the side because I've done that. And I met Ben Hogan. I know Tiger well, and I revere Bob Jones. But, you know, Bob Jones was the ultimate gentleman. He's the only one to win a calendar Grand Slam. Hogan had this mystique, and he, you know, arguably controlled the ball as well as anybody that ever played the game. And then Tiger, as I mentioned earlier, I witnessed him at all three U.S. Juniors. I mean, I officiated, worked it. All three U.S. Amateurs and all three U.S. Opens, and I watched what he did, and it's amazing. So I would probably, if it was that group, I'd probably either pick the old course of St. Andrews or Cypress Point. Wow, would that be a dream foursome.
By the way, that 08 victory by Tiger at Torrey Pines, for you, in terms of what you've seen in your career? Was that the greatest accomplishment, considering what he was on basically one leg, if you will, that you've ever seen somebody accomplish in golf?
You know, Kelly, I think it is. And I'll tell you why. I found out Mark Steinberg, his agent, well, when I was involved with helping doing pairings the week before, we knew Tiger was suspect. We didn't know why. Huh. So I called up Mark and I said, Mark, for the first time ever, we're going to put world number 1, 2, and 3 together. So that was Woods, Mickelson, and I remember it was Adam Scott. But I don't want to do it if Tiger's going to withdraw. And so Mark responded saying, Mike, I really think he's planning to play. He loves Torrey Pines. He grew up in Southern California. He's going to play. So fast forward to early, it's like 6 in the morning, on Tuesday morning of the U.S. Open, and Mark Steinberg's calling my cell, and I'm like, oh, the pairings were already out, and I think, here we go. And he called to say, Mike, I need to let you know what's going on with Tiger medically. He goes, but you can't tell anybody. And I didn't tell anybody from the USGA or anybody else. But he goes, he essentially said he's got 3 fractures in his leg. And so it made it, and I officiated his group on Saturday and Sunday, and then the playoff when he was playing against Rocco. And witnessing what he did, making eagles, hitting it. He hit it all over the place, but his recovery shots, it was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And knowing that he had to make that, literally that commitment mentally at impact on virtually every full shot to know it was going to hurt like crazy, but it's a mind over matter with Tiger. And I do think, even though he won the U.S. Open in 2000 by 15 shots, he made some remarkable comebacks in his amateur championships. I still think 08 was the most amazing thing I've seen when I was at the USGA in championship golf, at least USGA championships.
Is it safe to say that the Tiger willed his way to that championship, Mike?
I really do believe he willed it in. I'm not sure he would have played had it not been Southern California, but it is that amazing. In that, he was not, there was no, that was real pain that he was in. And he just committed that at impact, it was going to kill him. And he was just going to, you know, continue the swing. And so he kind of worked his way around the course, and he just figured out a way to get the ball in the hole in as few strokes as he could. And I look back, and it's just, I've talked to him about it too before. And I think he realizes when he looks back how amazing that was. And it would be interesting with all the things Tiger Woods done in his career, to ask him what he thinks his most amazing moment. I don't know what that would be, but I can't imagine 2008 wouldn't at least be up there pretty close to number one.
Mike, let's wrap this up as we began with a discussion about Apogee. You've still got, what, 2 golf courses to complete. Is that correct? What's your timeline for completion of everything? And please let our listeners know where they can go to learn more about Apogee.
So, Kelly, we are building the second golf course now. We've got 2 holes that are in the process of being grassed and another 7 holes that are being shaped in various stages. If everything goes to schedule, we will open the second golf course December of this year. That's the one Tommy and I are designing. The third golf course we'll start building probably third quarter of this year. And if everything goes to schedule, and that's the Kyle Phillips course, we will open that December of 25. So ultimately, I do hope, if you know, we don't get hurricanes or whatever, that we'll be fully built out for golf by the end of 2025. And some of the vertical things, the second clubhouse and so on, won't get completed until 2026. But it's a big, bold project. And, you know, we do have a website, apogeeclub.com. So,
Mike Davis, we cannot thank you enough. Your passion for what you did all the years with the USGA and golf course setup and running the association, and now what you're doing at Apogee. Appreciate your time very much. And we just got to get our good buddy Bob Bupka back on the course with us here.
We do indeed. And Kelly, it was so nice being with you. I've admired your work over the years, and we've known each other for quite some time. And thanks so much for having me. I'm honored to be a part of this.
Introducing the epitome of golfing elegance and performance from William & Harry. Immerse yourself in style and unparalleled comfort as you step onto the green with William & Harry's unique durable deerskin and calfskin masterpiece. Unrivaled in its water-resistant design, the new and improved WH shoe, which is also available in private label, ensures that you stay focused on your swing, even in unpredictable weather conditions. So elevate your game to where luxury meets peak performance. Step into excellence. Step into innovation at williamandharry.com. Yeah, Bob, you hear that interview with Mike Davis, and it really does show people who have such a great passion for golf. And to see what he's doing with this Apogee project is amazing. But I got to tell you, though, I'm always going to identify Mike with his days at the USGA, and he really did do a great job for them. And the golf course setups at the US Open, boy, they're always going to be the great challenge, right?
And I got another challenge from Mike Davis. Why not open up a passion for golf school? Nobody has more passion for the sport, and nobody could educate the masses more on what a wonderful sport golf really is.
We thank Mike Davis very much for his time. Next week, the great Bernhard Langer is going to be joining us. Unfortunately, he's sidelined a little bit in terms of playing, but he will be our guest on Musings on Golf. My good friend Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off. Thank you all for joining us here on Musings on Golf.